Thanks for listening to WBUR, made possible with support from Wistia and ZipRecruiter, presenting Endless Thread, the new podcast that brings Reddit, the front page of the internet, to your earbuds. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If President Donald Trump's meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un goes ahead, and as of today, that's a big if, since North Korea has threatened to pull out of that meeting. But if it happens, what kind of relationship might the two men have? And what effect would that have on the relations between their two nations? Now, there are examples in very recent history about how things can get personal and even ugly when we're talking about representatives, top-level representatives of major global powers. I mean, consider what happened to Michael McFaul. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. And in 2012, as Vladimir Putin was running for election in Russia, McFaul found himself the victim of a viral video that accused him of being a pedophile. And to this day, searches for McFaul's name and the word pedophile turn up millions of hits on Russian search engines. And it's just one of the stories that McFaul tells in his new political memoir. It's called From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. And Michael McFaul joins us now. Ambassador, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
In just a couple of minutes, we're going to bring in Admiral James Stavridis. He's the dean of the Fletcher School
That's always
of
wise.
Law and Diplomacy, and also
That's
former Supreme
man, yes.
Yeah, Allied Commander of NATO. And NATO plays a big role in the story that you tell here in the book. But Ambassador, I just wanted to start off with hearing a little bit more about this story, about this viral video. And I bring it up because I think it's very demonstrative of the things that Vladimir Putin was capable of doing even as far back as 2012. But first of all, was it Putin behind that video?
Well, we have no way of knowing. And that's the way the Putin regime works. They always use cutouts. It's never directly from the Kremlin. Same way in 2016, by the way, the things that they've done. So I don't assume that it was him. But was there a broad campaign against me personally, against President Obama himself, where they described him as being a supporter of ISIS during the same time? That was crystal clear. And those television stations, primary television, because that's where Russians get their media from, they are all controlled by the Kremlin. And it was designed for a purpose. It wasn't just something personal about me. It was designed for a purpose because at that time, there were big demonstrations against Putin and his regime. And so they needed to mobilize their base against the West. They pulled out a kind of old Cold War narrative that the West was out to get them. And they blamed us, America, Obama, and me, for supporting, allegedly, we weren't, but for supporting the democratic opposition rallying against Putin.
So this is 2012. Obviously, 2016 and Russian meddling in the U.S. election is what immediately comes to mind.
It should.
But how did the Obama administration, how did you as ambassador respond in 2012? I mean, to this viral video.
Well, it's hard. And I'm glad we're talking about it because now we're talking about fake news and disinformation. And many Americans have just become aware of this phenomenon. But several years ago, of course, we were experiencing it directly. And it's difficult. What do? You get on Twitter and say, I'm not a pedophile? That doesn't work too well. Then some people start arguing with you. You know, my wife didn't even want me to put this story in the book, just so you know, because she thinks once you say that, suddenly people are thinking in different ways about you. And that's how disinformation works. And remember, Putin's not trying to win the argument about anything. He's just trying to make a mess about the truth and falsehoods. And that's how disinformation works. And it worked, I think, tragically, successfully against our administration.
Well, so I'm curious what you think about this, because I imagine that critics of the Obama administration would say that, first of all, in 2016, the administration's response to what they knew at the time about Russian meddling wasn't robust enough.
Yes.
Sounds like, I mean, if you say it was hard and you didn't really know what to do in 2012, that it also wasn't robust enough. I mean, was this basically, were there multiple times, before 2016 where the United States failed to push back against Vladimir Putin on these things?
Yes, I think there was.
But why?
Well, a couple of reasons. And remember, I'd left the government in 2014, but all my friends are still at the White House through 2016. And I would say a couple of things. One, this was new in American electoral politics. These were instruments of power that we'd seen in Russia and in countries near Russia, but we'd never seen it inside our own country. And both the stealing of information and then publishing it through WikiLeaks, that was something new. But also disinformation on our social media websites from Russia. We had never seen it. So that's number one. Number two, as they would tell you if they were here with you, my White House friends, they didn't want to weigh in because they were afraid of being accused of helping Secretary Clinton. That was a hard call. I want to make sure everybody understands for me that was a hard call. But I write about it in my book. I think they should have done more, particularly on this day, October 7th, 2016. They put out their statement. And I was at the White House before I went to Moscow. I know how you roll out a statement if you want to get it attention. You have it come out of the White House. You have a press conference about it.
But you don't know that an Access Hollywood tape is going to break.
Well, we didn't know that. That was a problem for them. But they rolled it slow. They didn't do that kind of thing. I think that was a mistake. And then don't forget, there are other actors involved here. Facebook, Twitter, they are also seeing this stuff for the first time, not fully understanding it and not fully understanding how to deal with it. And I deal with those companies quite a bit right now. I think they now see that it's no longer sufficient to say that we don't have an editorial policy. Algorithms are editorial policy. But back then it was brand new and they were just trying to figure it out in real time. Mm. And so they were slow to react.
So let me just go back to the 2012 moment again. And in fact, what I want to do is actually go back even further, because it's interesting to me that Putin used you in 2012. I mean, you were U.S. ambassador, so obviously very, very high profile in Russia, but as this poster boy for
literally, I was a poster boy, by the way. They made posters of me.
As the target for the grievances that he wanted to stoke in the electorate around his election.
Right.
But because it was just a couple of years before that, though, that, you know, there was the famous reset with U.S.-Russia relations. You're the architect of that reset. I mean, it was, what, 3 or 4 years in that time? How did things change so quickly?
Well, I am the architect of that, and that word is mine for better or for ill. And we had a fantastic run with the Russians. I'm glad you reminded your listeners. There was a period of cooperation with President Medvedev, not President Putin, and we got the START treaty done, bringing down by 30% the number of nuclear weapons allowed in the world. Sanctions on Iran that led to the Iran deal, which I think is a great deal. New supply routes to Afghanistan, Russian WTO. And back then, not just to ancient history, but 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the majority of Russians has a positive view of us and vice versa. It's a complicated story. That's why I wrote the book to explain it. But the punchline is two things happened. One, Putin comes back into power, and he has a different view about us. He sees us more in zero-sum terms, whereas Medvedev thought about win-win outcomes in cooperating with us. But then, two, back to when I arrived, demonstrations were against Putin, and he needed a new argument to win re-election. And so he made us the enemy again. And as you said, poster child, I just happened to arrive right in that mess. And one of his advisors said to me, you know, remember, I've been living in and out of that country for 30 years. I got a lot of friends in the government. And one of them, a Kremlin person, said, you know, Mike, don't take anything personal. We're just going to use you for this election, and then we're going to get back to normal. And I was like, pedophile? I'm not going to take that personal. I'm sorry. But it turned out we didn't get back to normal because he needed to keep that mobilization against us.
So I'm going to bring in Dean Stavridis here in just a second. But there's one piece of tape I want to play for you because, I mean, you were describing this good run that the U.S. had with the Russians. And there are even U.S.-based analysts who see it a little differently.
Yes.
Right? I mean, just last week, you participated in a debate with Stephen Cohen.
Yes, I did.
Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies.
That's a pretty different view than
at
me.
At NYU and Princeton. And he basically said to you that during the Obama reset, the U.S. was asking Russia for significant concessions, but he says the U.S. didn't give up very much in return. And here's Cohen.
This was called selective cooperation. And best I understand this expression, Professor McFaul has used it, so has Mrs. Clinton and others. Selective cooperation means we get they give, and we pretend it's diplomatic cooperation.
What do you say?
Well, two things. back then, it was not selective cooperation. That comes when Putin comes in. We were cooperating on everything. We were cooperating on airspace and civil society. We even had, we had 22 working groups with the Russians back at the height of the reset. But number two, with all my respect for Professor Cohen's academic work, diplomacy is not about concessions. Nobody ever does anybody any favors in international diplomacy, especially not with the Russians. And so the idea that we're going to give them concessions and they're going to give us, it doesn't work that way. It has to be where both sides think that they're better off to sign this deal. Medvedev didn't sign the START Treaty as a concession to America. He signed it because he thought it was in Russia's national interest. He didn't sign up for sanctions on Iran as a gift to his buddy Barak. He did it because he thought it was in Russia's national interest. And when Putin comes in, he has a different definition
of what Russian national interests are.
And let me tell you, yeah. I worked at the White House. You don't come in and get some blue book off the table that says, here is America's interest to follow this. Individuals matter and individuals define it in different ways.
Okay. Absolutely fascinating. It's the perfect entree to
Great.
James Stavridis.
Yeah.
He's the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and also former Supreme Allied Commander for NATO in Europe. Dean Stavridis, it's always great to have you. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Magna. How are you? And my best to Ambassador McFaul, who's a very close friend. Hi, Mike.
Good to have you here, Jim.
So we're trying to sort of cover a lot of complex ground here, James Stavridis, but I want to get your take on something that Michael McFaul just said, that Vladimir Putin defines what is in Russia's best national interest different than his predecessors or differently. And that brings, to my mind, that brings NATO into the picture here, right? Because you know, NATO is on Russia's doorstep. And so is it understandable, perhaps even forgivable, for Vladimir Putin to take a much more bellicose nationalistic posture when he sees the Western alliance just across his borders?
I think it's understandable, but not forgivable. So the way I would start is by saying, to understand Russia, you just have to understand the history and culture and the way that strong masculine figures over time dominate that landscape. You kind of roll the cosmic dice. Sometimes it works out. You get Peter the Great. The next time you get Ivan the Terrible. Maybe you get a Stalin, but then you get a Gorbachev. You get a Medvedev, as Mike points out, and you have some trade space. But then those cosmic dice have landed on Vladimir Putin. So to understand Russia, I think from this moment forward, throughout the lifespan of Vladimir Putin, we have to understand Putin, which brings us to the answer to your question. And it is his background as a KGB agent. He grew up, was weaned on the poisonous NATO. And as he did see NATO countries join, who had formerly been under the Soviet Union, that was very unappealing to him. And I hasten to say, by the way, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, hey, no NATO tanks rolled into those countries forcing them to join NATO. They begged to join NATO. Why? Because they'd spent decades under the boot of the Soviet Union. So Putin sees that. He's bitter. He believes that the collapse of the Soviet Union, quote, was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, end quote. And all that anger, I think, is central to his worldview. So his objective, frankly, is to break the United States away from NATO. And that's what a lot of the fake news, the cyber, is intended to do. And it's going pretty well so far from his perspective.
Michael McFaul, jump in here.
I agree, and let's start calling him Admiral Stavridis because he really earned that title. I didn't earn my title ambassador. You know, professor I earned, ambassador I was for a while. That's a hard title to get, especially that long one he had at NATO too. Pretty cool, right?
Supreme Allied Commander.
I would just add a couple of things. One, countries get to choose who their allies are. Russia doesn't get a veto to that. Number two, NATO is a defensive alliance. You know, I like to say when I put an alarm up in my house, that's not a threat to my neighbor unless my neighbor plans to break in. And that's what NATO is. But number three, we had got this at a different place. at the height
can
of the
can I just, I'm here, I'm so sorry for, but, yeah, but my job is to play the foil to both of you. And your analogy of the alarm or the alarm system on the house is an interesting one, because doesn't Vladimir Putin, he doesn't see an alarm on your house. He sees guns on the fence to separating his property from yours.
He
That's
does,
what he sees.
And so do the Estonians on the other side of that fence. Yeah. And when you look at the balance of conventional weapons, I think a lot of Americans haven't been paying attention to this. It is moving in a negative direction for us, where Putin has invested a lot on both more weapons, more soldiers, and more advanced weapons. So it's on both sides. But I want to bring in the leaders thing again, because the tease that you put at the beginning I think is really important. I was at the NATO summit in Lisbon, 2010. I was there with President Obama. We met with President Medvedev. We had a great conversation with him there in the context of Russia-NATO Council. The entire conversation was about cooperation. Mm. It was about missile defense cooperation. And don't believe me, listeners. Go Google Medvedev's speech at the NATO summit. And what you're going to hear there is not that we're threatened by NATO, but we've turned the page in a new era, because it was parked. I was at every meeting with Medvedev and Putin for 5 years, and on every phone call, NATO expansion was not an issue. And I think what happens, by the way, our critics, our conservative critics yelled about that we weren't doing enough on that. And what happens is, once you have the end of the reset, the conflict over Ukraine, then Putin goes back and pulls from history these things to remind us, this was a problem from before. It wasn't a problem during the reset.
James DeVries, let me turn back to you. And I just, we've just got a couple minutes left, and we always try to pack far too much into too short a period of time. But I want to ask you about sort of where we stand now, again, regarding Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Because I think arguably, Trump's comments about Putin during the campaign and even during the first months of his presidency aside, you could say his administration may have been tougher thus far on Russia than the Obama administration was, right? Like they've added sanctions, they've sent arms to the Ukraine. I mean, when you look at it at that level, how would you describe, you know, U.S.-Russia relations right now?
I would describe them as worse than I have seen them throughout my career. And I think that the curious thing here is the lack of personal criticism that the president is willing to levy on Putin, despite the fact that Putin is obviously at the center of all of this. And as Ambassador McFaul just correctly pointed out, we actually got along reasonably well with Russia until Putin took over. And since then, these relations have just continued to crater. I think the administration has been right in increasing sanctions and right in responding diplomatically. I think we need to be stronger in our responses, Magna, in cyber. We still have cards to play there that across a variety of cyber options that I think are worth doing. Bottom line, what we should be doing is confronting Russia where we must on Ukraine, their support for a war criminal Assad in Syria, on cyber and intrusion in our elections. But we should cooperate where we can. We can have a kind of a blended approach. I think that's the best we're going to do.
James DeVries, let me just,
Vladimir Putin.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but since you mentioned cyber, I just have to remind people that just this week, the White House eliminated a top cyber advisor position.
Which is very foolish, a very foolish proposition. We have a cabinet that is perfectly constructed for the 19th century. We have a Secretary of Agriculture, a Secretary of Interior who administers national parks, but we don't have a cabinet-level voice on cyber, and now we've taken it off the NSC staff. Big mistake.
Wow. Well, James DeVries is the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's also former Supreme Allied Commander for NATO in Europe. Admiral DeVries, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna. Thanks to Mike McFaul, too. I'll see you in Montana this summer.
All right.
Montana native.
All right. We'll see you there.
My invitation must have been lost in the mail.
You're always welcome.
Ambassador McFaul, last question. We've just got 30 seconds here. I mean, you tell a very detailed story in the book, and obviously we're only scratching the surface here.
That's why people need to buy the book.
But when you say Cold War to hot peace, it's the hot word that concerns me. Like, do you share the same alarm that James DeVries just shared with us?
Yeah, I use that phrase on purpose to echo elements of the Cold War, because there are things that are new, but it's not Cold War 2.0, because some things are different. Cyber is new. That's a totally new world that we did not encounter in the Cold War. Annexation. We thought annexation was done. In the Cold War, there was not annexation. Now we're back to that. And in particular, Putin is willing to use his power in a much more aggressive way than the last Cold War leaders. That makes it a very dangerous world.
Well, Michael McFaul was U.S. ambassador to Russia between 2012 to 2014. His new book is From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia, and he'll be talking about it tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7. Ambassador McFaul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.